order. I'd like to open up a work session on SB 47. You remember this bill from a week ago. We were about ready to vote on it, but we didn't have the proper paperwork from the revenue or fiscal offices. We do have that paperwork now. And Dana, if you wouldn't mind refreshing us with a summary of what it does with our two amendments that we added to it.
Yeah, not at all. This is out of the work groups on the confidentiality agreements, and it authorizes the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to reprimand or suspend or revoke the right for license or registration for a person enrolled in an approved teacher education institution or program. The dash one amendments that we adopted removed suspension or expulsion from an institution or program as grounds to suspend or revoke the right to apply. It was felt that those were subsumed in another section. The dash two amendments were drafted in response to concerns with the TSPC's DOJ and advice that they had gotten about how we were changing crimes that the commission could consider in revoking the right to apply, and so our dash two amendments addressed those and clarified the authority of TSPC to deny, suspend, or revoke a license solely for conviction of certain crimes. So we adopted those.
Okay.
When we last saw this guy.
Senator Bonamici, do you have any, you mentioned...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I could just ask for a clarification, because as I was reviewing this information prior to this hearing, I noticed that the letter that came from the TSPC with the written testimony last week said that the TSPC attorney has advised us that the removal of the language on page 3, line 14, would have serious unintended consequences and would increase the commission's discretion around crime significantly. And there was some suggestion that that was going to be restored. And I just wanted to confirm that, in fact, because the language was not restored in one of the amendments, that that concern was dealt with in the, I believe it's the dash two. So if I could get some confirmation of that, I'd feel more comfortable. Thank you.
Okay. We have Vicki Chamberlain. If you wouldn't mind stepping up and helping us.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. The dash two amendments were written with legislative counsel and my DOJ attorney involved. So the way it has been fixed is by adding Section 5 to the bill. Chapter 670-280 applies to all licensure agencies, and really what we were quibbling about is this language has been around for a long time, and it basically says that if there's a mandatory crime, you don't look at intent or anything else. You just, it's a crime and it happens and you revoke the license. If it's any other crime, then like all other licensure agencies, we would look at what were the circumstances and all of that around that. The way the bill was originally drafted the first time, all of that had been removed and the connection had been removed. So now it's been restored in 670. And so if you look in number 5 here.
Of the amendments?
Of the amendments, I'm sorry. So which is the front page of the dash 2 amendments. And if you look at line 18, by inserting this cross-reference in that important language, which was not there before, it was just in the top paragraph, this ensures that we will continue to treat crimes like we always have, and legislative counsel in an effort to clean up has taken references to 670 out of our statute, and all we were arguing for, it doesn't give great notice to people who are in our statutes to go look at 670, but 670 still legally applies, and we would have to count on DOJ to walk them through that. But regardless, you can't apply our chapter in absence of reviewing 670, which says that in crimes other than mandatory crimes, the commission has to take into consideration the conduct, how old the crime is, and other things related to that, like all other licensure agencies. I just really hope that didn't sound like legal gobbledygook.
My
attorney's happy except for an and or an or, so...
Amazing what damage you can do with one little word like notwithstanding.
Senator Bonamici, do anything with it.
Is that
Well, notwithstanding disparaging lawyers, yes, no, that clarified it. I was just concerned because the written testimony did say that they were requesting an amendment to remove that or to reinstate that language. And when I saw that that hadn't happened, I just wanted to make sure that was done.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions on SB 47?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 47 as amended to the floor with a due pass of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves SB 47 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes. Senator Bonamici, you feel like the perfect person to carry this on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be honored to do that.
All right. I would like to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 75, Senate Bill 197, and Senate Bill 323. I believe we're going to start with Senate Bill 323. However, I'm not sure the sponsor is here. So let's start with the Governor's Office and Senate Bill 75.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to do a brief summary of Senate Bill 75?
Please.
Senate Bill 75 establishes a procedure for the governor to voluntarily transfer the duties of office to the acting governor when the governor expects to be temporarily unable to discharge the duties of the office. It establishes a disability evaluation panel and authorizes certain state officials to convoke the disability evaluation panel. It establishes a procedure for the disability evaluation panel to find that the governor is unable to discharge the duties of the office or is able to resume the duties of the office. It repeals current statutes on the disabilities of the governor.
Thank you. I'm always fascinated by succession of power discussions. So,
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Evans. I'm the governor's policy advisor for military emergency management of veterans issues. Thank you for allowing us to come forward today. I've been instructed to keep it as short as possible. So here's the situation. Currently, the succession powers is a little bit confusing. We didn't really know that until Top Off 4, which, as you recall, was a homeland security exercise that we took part in October of 2007. At that time, the panel that would decide whether or not the governor could or couldn't fulfill her duties consisted of an ear, nose, and throat specialist, a judge, and a psychiatrist. And that panel was supposed to be able to tell if the governor's ongoing theoretical heart condition was, in fact, limiting his powers. This is a fix for that. It basically adds to Oregon law provision that will allow the governor to voluntarily transfer power to an acting governor for a finite period of time. And it cleans up the measure and reworks as far as what kind of panel could more rationally determine whether or not the governor could or could not fulfill their duties.
Appreciate you trying to be brief here. I know the governor. We didn't have time for him to come down. I told that to his staff earlier, and maybe next time if you want to pass that on.
Yes, sir.
But as I understand it, he feigned incapacitation during the top off, unbeknownst to anyone, and that was what revealed the flaws here because some people on this panel were out of town.
Yes and no. He had given us warning of about a day that we were going to participate in this, but to exercise the system, we didn't give the three members that are currently in the law a warning, which was a little bit of a surprise to pretty much everybody. It did work. It just didn't work as well as we thought it could, and it didn't really provide a lot of flexibility. For example, if, for instance, the dean of the law school or the dean of the medical school could not get there because of incapacitation himself or because of another kind of emergency, or if the Chief Justice couldn't take part, it created a little bit of confusion as to what we would do then. This actually provides more flexibility with who can fulfill those responsibilities to be predetermined beforehand.
Questions, Mr. Evans? Anybody have signed up? Senator Morse.
Mr. Chair, I very much endorse the bill. I do have a question about Section 3, lines 44 and 45. As I read that, Mr. Chair, any one of those individuals individually could order, trigger the convocation of this disability panel. And I'm wondering if it might be better if you had two of the five or three of the five, mm-hmm. so that you avoid any potential for kind of ill will, if you may, for partisan or political or personal reasons, so that it becomes a little more of an objective process. That would be my recommendation for actually for an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Because I suppose that all, that possibility always exists. Mr. Evans, your thoughts on that?
Chair House, Senator Morris, at this point, the reason that the upgrade was basically consistent with the current statute, that any currently any one of the folks involved could ask for that. But I think that a two of or a three of is not an an unreasonable addition to it. We just want to make sure that the citizens of Oregon have a clear, transparent system for knowing how their governor will or will not be returned to power.
And that, too, would add to just practicality of just, you know, people being available and out of town, out of country.
Right.
If I could, Senator Morris got a good idea. I guess I would suggest two rather than three. I mean, we don't know. I mean, if we're dealing with catastrophic events where the people just aren't available, convening three even by telephone could become difficult. And chances are that two of these are going to be available almost certainly. And but it does keep it from being one person being able to do that. So, I mean, if two would be a good number, I think that would be workable.
Mm-hmm. When he feigned his incapacitation, what did he do?
The governor is a very talented man, sir.
Well, I know. I wish I had time for him today, but
quite frankly, at first we didn't know that it was an act, which created a little bit of a problem because the actual people were in the room that could take the authority away. So the governor was very convincing, and he basically feigned memory loss and some of the symptoms of not knowing where he was at. There were some other inputs put in having to do with heartbeat, overall ability to concentrate. It was a very good experience to watch that process. And, again, everybody involved did their very best. We just think that maybe an ear, nose, and throat specialist and a psychiatrist are not the best to, in every case to be the expert.
Wait, so you were there?
Yes, sir.
Was there a defibrillator nearby?
There was. We did not keep it anywhere near because, really, I don't trust myself with electronic equipment, much less other people. But there was an automatic defibrillator around.
Okay, further questions? Senator Bonamici?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a question. I just want to let the committee know that I was actually observing top off at one of the remote locations when this happened, and it was a very interesting among the people who were observing to try to figure out. It didn't take us long to figure out that it was real, that it was a part of the exercise and that it wasn't real, but it was a very interesting experience. So I support the bill. I don't know what you plan to do in terms of changing that to two people to get the panel together.
I think if it's okay, we'll look at an amendment. Maybe we'll have some alternatives to maybe pick and choose from. I have a feeling that if I feigned memory loss and being disoriented, that nobody would see any difference and wouldn't see anything out of order. So,
well, Chair Haas, one of the challenges of that particular exercise was that the virtual news network that was reporting on the exercise actually, it was never scripted in, and they heard about it. So then it was scripted in, and we had to explain how Oregon was trying to put our governor back into authority. So that was an interesting lesson learned. As far as the two members, if it is at all possible, because we do want to kind of get this one out of the way, if that is the only amendment, anything we can do to try to answer any questions to make sure we can kind of move this down the track would be good, because we see it kind of as a housekeeping issue where now that we know that there's a problem, we want to make sure it's taken care of.
Fair enough. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Evans.
Yes, sir.
Senate Bill 197, we're in a public hearing and work session on that, the PUC.
Mr. Chair, would you like a brief description of this bill?
Please.
Senate Bill 197 permits the Public Utility Commission to use temporary status appointments for student law clerks up to 24 months. It declares an emergency as an effective upon passage.
Colleagues, this falls under the category of why is there even a law? And why do we have to change it? And I drew one of those answers of because. And so,
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Lee Beyer. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I have with me Mike Grant, who is the PUC's chief law judge. And, Mr. Chair, I would agree with your comments, but it's there. So we're asking for a little flexibility. I think the reason it's there is we're talking about, under the general personnel rules, temporary appointments to that. Temporary appointments are normally only allowed for 6 months, except for this statute, which has exceptions for the use of law students as law clerks. Currently, Department of Justice and the Central Hearings Panel have an exception to that, allowing for the appointment of a law student to clerk for up to 24 months. PUC does not. We use law clerks and would like to have that same flexibility, although I will tell you that it would be the rare exception when one would go more than a year, although the clerks, and I think probably Senator Bonamici could attest to that, usually the law students like to clerk in one place for at least a year to get the experience. From our perspective, it works easier that way to have one there, given a full year of experience working in the utility environment. It's a fairly technical area. There's sort of a trade-off. There's certainly use, their value at the start, but their value increases over time. The value to the agency obviously increases the longer they're there. So there's kind of a trade-off from them. The students need a longer period of time to gain the experience they're desiring, and we would like to have them around a little longer. It's a lower-cost way for us to meet that need. So that's essentially the nature of the request. Again, it would put the PUC in the same position as two other similar state agencies that use law clerks. So, Mr. Chair, that's it in a nutshell, and I will keep it short because I think it's not a real complicated issue.
Okay. Commissioner, how many people are we talking about here?
Usually, in fact, the while that I've been on the commission, we've never had more than one clerk at a time.
Okay. What's the next step? It's common for these guys in their next move after clerking.
Law school is traditionally 3 years. Usually no one will bring them on to clerk until after the first year, so you're usually talking about their second and third
usually
year.
Usually second year.
Most students will want to they'll clerk a year in one place and then they'd like to clerk someplace else for the second year. Although, occasionally they'll want to stay in one place for a couple of years. Depends if they want to specialize in one area or get a little more diversity on their resume.
Questions?
You ready to roll?
We're in work session.
You ready?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 197 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 197 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to this bill? Seeing none, motion passes. Senator Morris, would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Still waiting for Peter.
We are.
All right, let's go to Senate Bill 181. I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 323 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 81, the Lottery Commission. If you could read a summary, Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 81 expands the type of performance security the Oregon State Lottery Commission may accept from a lottery contractor. We have before you a -1 amendment that specifies that the amount of performance security must be acceptable to the commission, and it permits a surety to be issued by entities or individuals.
Welcome. This feels a little bit like deja vu for those of us who were in the committee on a very similar bill.
Chair Hass and committee members, for the record, Larry Nicewinder, Deputy Director, Oregon Lottery. I'm accompanied today at the table with Mary Bray, the Contracts Officer for Oregon Lottery. Just want to make a few brief comments about this bill. It is a bill that applies to a lottery exclusively as a state agency, and it does expand the types of performance security the Oregon Lottery can accept when it enters into certain contracts. It really is a housekeeping bill. In many respects, at the time the statute was set in motion in 1985, this may have been a common practice and may have been an exclusive form of performance security that was available. Things have changed considerably since then, and as reflected in our testimony, there are lots of other more effective, practical, less expensive, easier to get forms of security that lottery would like to have the flexibility to use, as well as many of the vendors that we work with. So Section 2 of the bill does delete the requirement for that only to be done through a performance bond and brings back language that says that vendors shall post performance security as a general term, which does allow us broader ability to accept such things as letters of credit, cashier's checks, other forms of security that are much more secure, more effective, and less expensive. So this is modeled after some statutes that have already moved on ahead of ours. ORS Chapter 279 already has the same kind of language already in it. So we're really trying to catch up. There were some amendments. We've worked very closely with the Department of Justice in the crafting of the bill. There were a couple minor wording changes that came to light late in the bill drafting process, and so that's why we have the Dash 1 amendments prepared for your review, and there really is just for clarity in that we want any form of security to be acceptable to the commission, whether it's from an institution, insurer, escrow agent, or other person. So it's really for clarity purposes only. There is no fiscal impact or revenue impact to the bill. There's no known opposition to the bill. And we request your support in passage.
For purposes of discussion, can you elaborate on a layman's definition of posting performance security?
Chair Haas, for the record, my name is Mary Bray. I'm the Procurement and Contracts Officer for Lottery. Posting performance security, when a vendor contracts with us, what they do is they deliver a copy of a performance bond from their surety. And the current statute requires that it come at the time the contract is executed, which in most cases has been impossible since the sureties won't issue the performance bond until the contract is signed. So we have a little bit of a timing discrepancy there, but what they do is they give us actual evidence that they have contracted with a surety to cover the performance that's required under the contract that they have with Lottery.
Okay. Questions? I know you mentioned, you alluded to this here, but without passage of this, Where's the hang up here? Looking forward, where's your logistical, practical bumps?
A couple of companies very recently have come to us and have had a difficult time getting a performance bond or finding performance bonds very expensive. Performance bonds are very common in the construction industry, and what they do is they'll permit substitute performance if the primary contractor for some reason breaches or walks and is unable to complete the job. And in construction, it makes sense. In the lottery business, where our contracts with our vendors are highly specialized, there's not a lot of video lottery terminal vendors out there, for example, software programmers for our games, it's very difficult to get effective substitute performance. So the security that we're looking for, we want to complete getting what we've contracted for, but the more practical way to do it would be to take funds or money and go and find our own contractor that we're comfortable with, rather than turning that over to the surety under a performance bond situation. It's the surety that picks the substitute performance and not lottery itself.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I didn't hear correctly, but you're in essence wanting to void the requirement for a performance bond?
Not void. The performance bond would still be an option. We're just asking for the ability to have the commission approve a performance security that's acceptable to the commission. So whether it be a performance bond or a cashier's check or an irrevocable letter of credit or even cash, what we would have to do is look at each individual situation and then make a determination on what would be the best performance security for the lottery under that particular scenario.
So just as a part of, so the intent is not to eliminate the requirement for some type of surety.
Correct.
It's just to have greater flexibility.
Greater flexibility, correct.
Yeah. And I can understand why you'd want to be in the driver's seat as opposed to a bonding company and having to work through that with the time deadlines and just your flow of business.
Correct. Thank you.
Other questions? Colleagues, this is not pre-wired here. We have no compunction not to pass this unless you want to wait.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair? Thank you. I have a question about how often you enter into the contracts and whether you have someone there. It sounds like you have to do a lot more assessing under the provisions of this bill. You'll have to go through that analysis that you just described about all the different considerations based on that particular entity. Is that going to take a lot of additional time? Do you have someone already on the staff to do that? Is this something that happens like twice a day or twice a month? Or if I could get a sense. Because there's no expenditure revenue impact.
Senator Bonamici, right now with the performance bond analysis, historically, we have asked for the value of the contract in performance bond. I'm not sure where that came from, but as practice, it doesn't take a lot of analysis to figure out. We know the contract value, so we know what we need to ask for performance bond. Generally, that's the value to which we want to protect ourselves. So if it's a $35 million contract, for example, we get a $35 million performance bond to cover us for the initial deployment period. For example, in VLTs, they're usually deployed over a one-year period. That's the high-risk period for the lottery. And then after that first year, the value that we require will drop generally to $1 million. So there's not a lot of analysis or time that goes into determining the amount. And we anticipate that it would be the same with whether it's an irrevocable letter of credit or cash, it would be the amount of the contract at the time it was entered into. And then getting over the hump of the greatest risk area, that amount would then go down.
And just to follow up, Mr. Sure. Chair, and how often are you entering into these contracts?
Right now, we require performance bonds from our major, they're called major procurements, and those are the contractors that deal with determining the lottery winners, determining the winning numbers, dealing with our sensitive lottery equipment. We have right now 9 contracts with major contractors. Some of them are 7-year term contracts, some of them are 5, some of them are renewable annually. So it's not a huge amount, but the risk amount is high, and that's why the performance bond is a something that's really front and center in all of these major. They're really our biggest contractors that we have. So,
thank you.
Other questions? Ready to go? I'm ready to go.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 81.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, Senate Bill 81. Discussion? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 81 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 81 as amended to the floor with a do-pass.
As amended.
With a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes. Thank you all. Carrier, Senator Metzger?
Sure.
Do we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 323? Mr. President?
Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 323 allows persons required to submit written reports to the Legislative Assembly to do so through posting an electronic form of the report on the Internet and providing that location in executive summary to members. It requires a physical distribution of a copy to legislators still. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage.
Mr. President, thank you for coming. Welcome.
Thank you. Does that mean I begin?
Yes, it means we can begin.
Thank you, Chair Hess and members of the Senate Education General Government. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator. I represent District 11. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem, 97303. Before me, right here, this thing here. You see just one of the many reports that my office receives every year. Senate Bill 2323 is a bill which clarifies the options open to agencies required to submit reports to presiding officers of the Oregon Legislature. These reports are important representations of the meaningful work that agencies complete. However, as our methods change and our offices rely more on electronic storage, it makes sense to allow the agencies to conserve dollars and resources by simply posting these reports online and notifying us of their publication in the executive summary. This does not change the method through which agencies communicate to each legislator. The executive summaries that they are required to submit will still be distributed to each and every legislator. I feel strongly that this is a positive step forward to deal with shrinking budgets and to conserve time and resources without restricting public access to important information. Now, you might want to know why it takes a law, because Legislative Council said it did. So that's why we had to introduce this bill. So
the second one of these we've had today. So
I hate to. We'd just soon not have it come in this form, just do it electronically, be done with it, and it takes a law to do that. That's the bill.
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. but if we do this, and I want that, because I don't do good looking at computer screens, I do good with paper. So if I want the full thing, the agency would still be compelled, if I request it, to provide that to me?
Could I ask that my policy director, Chair Hass, respond to Senator Cruz's question, please?
By all means. Give your name.
For the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. Chair Hass, Senator Cruz, yes, there is no change in this bill that would change the requirement of the agency. They are currently required to provide that for you as a legislator or any public member as requested, and there is no change to that in this law. This is simply related to the two reports that they provide to the presiding officers. This also does not obligate them to use the online format. They are just allowed to use the online format.
Other questions?
Mr. Wright asked the president about the game yesterday, but it's probably not appropriate.
You can read about it online.
Yeah.
Thank you. Am I done here?
Just a moment, please.
I have a question.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. President, for being here and for bringing this bill forward, because this is just the paper just since I've been sitting here that was duplicative. I really appreciate the intent of this, and I'm wondering why it still says that they still have to distribute one physical copy to each member of the Legislative Assembly.
The executive summary.
Oh, of the executive summary. Of the executive summary. Okay, thank you.
But your point, though, Senator Bonavici, is... Well, this is like the beginning of shrinking the paper around here.
Right. I appreciate that. So the executive summary, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
The executive summary will come to each member of the legislature. And are there other areas where that you're working on that will help reduce the volume of paper?
Chair Hass, Senator Bonamici, there certainly is lots of other opportunity for that. We were focused specifically on the presiding officer reports, which, as you can see, can be lengthy. The two pages we didn't want to presume to remove from other senators and legislators, but that certainly could be addressed.
Yes, you know, if this opens the door, so be it.
Mm-hmm. And someday, all of those bills that are hand-filed, that practice...
Well, if it just opens the door to here in terms of amendments to the bill to do some of the things that may be being suggested here, and I can't tell it, the tone of the questions, then let's go for it.
Yeah. Senator Morris?
Are you ready to go?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves 323 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, any objections to passing this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Seeing none, the bill is passed. We are almost cleared out with the
carrier, Mr. Chair.
This, carrier.
I think that the chief sponsor ought to carry it.
I agree. We'll sign it to the Senate President.
I agree.
Thank you. We are powering through these. We do have some introduction of committee bills. You all know that adopting introduction of these bills in no way infers opposition or support. Senator Morris, you have a list there.
Mr. Chair, if you're ready for a motion.
I am.
I move that LC 2845, dated 12909, LC 1570, dated 12809,
and 23,
LC 2434, dated 13009, and LC 2660, dated 2209, be introduced as committee bill.
209 BC.
Right.
Chair, Senator Morris moves that LC 2845, dated 12909, LC 1570, dated 12809, LC 2434, dated 13009, and LC 2660, dated 2209, be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Again, support for the introduction of this concept does not imply support for the measure. Discussion? Seeing none. If not, these measures are all introduced as committee bills. I think that finishes us off. We'll dismiss early. Thank you all. We are adjourned.